I would like to talk about the Buddhist concept of karma. It's a big topic, and you could spend years talking about it, and decades arguing about it. But karma is considered very important, and to get a little sense of its importance, karma, a number of Buddhist teachers, including Dalai Lama, have been asked what was more important, to understand the great Buddhist teachings about emptiness, great philosophical teachings, or to understand about karma, to understand about cause and effect. And the answer is, it's more important to understand about karma, about cause and effect. That's really much more essential. And because without understanding karma, you're not going to understand where you have personal responsibility, how to take responsibility. Some people who understand emptiness only will, or some of the kind of wonderful deeper teachings of Buddhism, will sometimes interpret that to mean that there's no personal responsibility, to abdicate responsibility, and everything's okay, and just kind of float along in life or something. So, when in a number of places, when the Buddha talked about the practice of Buddhism, he used a compound word, and the compound word is sati sampajana. And sati means mindfulness, which is one of the core practices we do here. And sampajana means wisdom, or understanding, or clear comprehension. And I like to think of these in part to be mindfulness focuses primarily understanding what is, what's going on, and learning how to be present for what is, how to be present for our experience. And it's a huge undertaking because it can be very hard to be present for life as it is because we have so much reactivity and judgments, interpretations that overlay it. So that mindfulness's primary task is to understand the way things are. Sampajana, or the wisdom side, has a lot to do with understanding how we can respond to the way things are. So rather than just leaving things as they are, as human beings, we often have to respond. We have to make choices about what we do in response. And there was a period of time in my Buddhist practice where I became very good at the first part of learning how to just be with things, let go of everything else, just let go, let go, let go, just be really present. And I could be very peaceful, very content, very happy, just being present by letting go. And that was quite fine for me when I was a monk. I didn't have to make a lot of choices. And then I became a parent. And just letting go and letting go and letting go and just being present just wasn't going to be enough. And, you know, laying in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and just let go, let go, let go, and the kid has a, you know, earache. You know, you got to get up and do something, or the two kids are fighting or something. And so you have to make some kind of choice about how do you interact, and you have to be I found I have to be creative and think ahead, and a lot of thought had to go into how do I respond to this situation. I can't just simply let go and be present in some way. Being present and letting go is very important, but there's more to it. Something's required of us. So what do we do about that part of life that's something that is required of us? And the Buddha's teachings about karma have a lot to do with this aspect of our life, you know, the place where we have choice and how we make choices. So the practice of mindfulness brings us to that place where we see we have a choice. We learn to be present for what is, but as we're present for what is not static. What is actually a process. It's an ongoing process of change and movement. And it's connected, and the present moment is part of a causal chain of cause and effect. There's cause and effect, and the effect is a cause for the next, you know, it just goes on and on. And we see this great sea, or the great kind of stream of cause and effect, And we find ourselves here in the present moment in that stream of change, of impermanence. And the question is, how do we relate to this big sea of change, of impermanence, always things changing? So the mindfulness places us, if mindfulness is clear, we learn how to rest and be present and be mindful in what's going on this moment, then we can start seeing where we have choice, where the moment of choice is. If a person does not see choice, then there is no choice, right, for that person. And so if we live somehow deluded, and we can't really see what's going on, then we don't see that we have a choice about what we do with our lives. But the more carefully we investigate, the more sensitive we get to the present moment, the more we see that there's a lot of choice each moment about how we react and respond and behave. And the more greater array of choice or choice places we see, the more choice we have, the more responsibility we can take. If a person sees no choice in their life, where they can make a choice, make a difference, then people will just feel victims of life, that their happiness and well-being, their peace, is just kind of at the sway of the conditions, causes and conditions around them in the world. And when the world is a good place, then we can be happy. And when the world is a bad place, or unfortunate things are happening, then we're unhappy. And so in a sense, we can become slaves to the happiness and unhappiness of our happiness is a slave to the causes and conditions external to us. But as we can see the places of choice, then we're not so much victims of circumstances, but we can actually have an influence on this causal chain of cause and effect that goes on. Make sense? So the teaching of karma has to do with a place of choice, the choices we make. And it gets very subtle if you want it to be. And the story I like to tell is after spending about 3 years at a Zen monastery, it was a bit surprised for me to leave the monastery and come back to San Francisco to live there. For many reasons, many ways it was a surprise. I'd been changed by the experience in the monastery. But one surprise was, I'll say it this way, in the monastery, much of the daily life was choreographed. You were told how to stand, how to sit, how to eat. There was a whole way in which you choreographed the way in which you ate most of the meals. And you had these bowls, and you had to lay them out a certain way, and you ate a particular way, and you put down your spoon in a certain way, and your chopsticks, you had a particular way to put them down, and your napkin you had to put in a certain way, and how you put it down was choreographed, and how you folded it up was choreographed, and everything was choreographed, And then they rang a bell, and then you stood up, and then they rang a bell, and you could walk out. But how you walked out was choreographed, and in fact, it was choreographed right down to which foot goes out the door first. So it's a lot of, it's well choreographed. So then I came back to San Francisco where life was not choreographed anymore. I discovered I had a lot of choices I had to make. That before, in a sense, the monastery was made for me. But the choice that really kind of stood out to me, was I had a choice about how I sat in a chair. I had never, before I went to the monastery, I didn't know I had a choice. It never occurred to me that chairs were a choice thing, right? You just sat in a chair. They say in Zen, when you sit, right? And it's pretty simple, right? You sit. But I found out actually there's a lot of choice because how I sat up, I could sit, I could slump, I could cross my legs, I could sit up straight. I could do all kinds of ways. And there's a lot of choices, small choices. And so before I went to the monastery, I didn't take advantage of those choices. In a sense, I was unconscious about how I sat in the chair. I would say, in a sense, I was unconscious of the choices I made about how I sit in the chair. After the monastery, it became harder to be unconscious about it, and I had to, make a choice. Do I sit up straight? Do I slump? How do I sit? And I noticed that how I sit in a chair affected my well-being sometimes. In fact, it had a big effect on many different things. It affected sometimes my own well-being, my energy. I noticed how sometimes if I was feeling kind of down, that if I let myself slump really low, that it would kind of subtly reinforce that feeling of being down. But if I sat up straight in kind of more energetic way, it kind of didn't necessarily take my blues away, but it made it paler, lighter blue. it made a little difference. And or how I sat had an impact on how I was in relationship to someone else who was sitting in another chair. If I was sitting all slumped down and kind of receding and tried disappearing in my chair, then I had a very different presence, a very different contact with someone over there than if I sat up and sat there facing them. So I saw all these little choices I had to make. I was in my 20s, and I also got interested in what it was like to fall in love. And I thought, I wonder if there's choice in falling in love, a choice point. You're supposed to fall in love. We're kind of victims of love, right? That's the Romeo and Juliet kind of scenario, and just kind of happens. And so I try to pay very careful attention to when I was attracted to someone or getting to know someone, to see if I could see if there was some turning point where I made a choice to go towards that person that somehow could represent kind of this idea of falling in love or being in love. And sometimes I could see there was just very subtle choices I made about leaning into someone or moving towards someone, or a choice to kind of pursue a certain desire or wish or want or something. And there were very subtle choices made there also. And when I was younger, when I was 19, then I can tell you definitively I had no choice in the matter. It was not a matter of choice. And so the time when I was 14, and there was no choice but to go through the entire telephone book and call every house that lived at the address on that street where she lived, and ask if, I forget her name now, but asked if she lived there. Because all I knew was the street she lived on, I knew her first name. And I had help. My friend went from the telephone book in the front, and I went from the back, and we called all the houses in that street until we found her. And there was no choice in the matter. It just had to be. So the place of choice. So mindfulness, one of the functions of mindfulness is to show us where we have choice. And then the question is, how do we make choices about how we act and how we respond? In all kinds of ways. What's the basis for making a choice? And there are many bases for choice. The Buddha's teachings of karma is one consideration around the choices we make. So karma in Sanskrit, or in Pali it's kamma, is the usual meaning is action. It means action. And it's related to words like to make and to do. And it's action. So it's activity. And so then there's all these action theories in India, theories about the efficacy of action. What happens to action? Once you make an action, is just done, just affects that particular circumstance where you just made it? Or does action have consequences in the next minute, or the next hour, or the next day, or the next year? What are the consequences of the actions we make? So karma theory has to do with the action and its consequences. When the Buddha showed up on the scene, there was a lot of karma theories, and the Buddha offered his own. And this is very important to understand, because when we, especially in popular English, here in America sometimes, people sometimes think that karma is just karma, just one theory of karma basically. But actually there's all kinds of theories about karma from different Indian religious traditions. And so we don't want to kind of assume that all the different theories about karma are the same, or the same as the Buddhist one. The Buddha defined, for the Buddha, the way he defined karma, even though it literally means action, he defined it as intention, as intentionality. So he's equating the karma with intention. So that has some explaining to do. So we live in a sea of cause and effect. And I like the word sea, because if you take like a pond and you throw a whole bunch of pebbles into the pond, you create a wave pattern, right? It ripples out in all directions, and the waves will hit each other and create other patterns, and those patterns will hit other patterns, and it gets very, very complex. The way that the, you know, if you just throw one pebble in, then it's very clear, you get this concentric waves going out. But if you throw 100 pebbles in, the number of cause and effect relationships of the way the waves hit each other becomes quite immense. And so if you put a rubber duck in that pond before you throw all those pebbles in, the which pebble is affecting the duck, making it bob up and down? Well, they all are. And they all are in this complicated way in which they all these pebbles and the waves are kind of interacting on the surface of the water. So in the same way, in this life of ours, we live in this big sea of cause and effect. And the ripples of cause and effect, and the way that all these ripples affect each other, then affect us. We're like ducks. And then somehow, you know, all this stuff is going on. And some of it is... So the question is, does everything that happens to us and everything relate to our karma? And some teachings about karma say that everything that happens to us in this life is a result of our past karma. So no matter what you do, it's, you know, whatever happens to you here is a result of the past karma. The Buddha did not say that. What the Buddha said is that the cause and that there's a big sea, big sea of cause and effect. And within that, there's a subcategory of cause and effect, which has to do with a cause and effect of intentionality, of the intentions we act on. So if we get sick, the Buddha specifically did not attribute all sickness to karma. It's just biological conditions, you know, or it's genetic conditions or whatever. And you don't have to attribute that to your karma. Or in one passage, the Buddha said, even if someone assaults you, that assault, you know, like you're stuck in a war or something, is not necessarily the result of your past karma. In a sense, you know, just bad luck. You happen to be born in a certain place, a certain time. There is a lot of people who would like the teachings on the karma to be a theory of justice. So that people really would like to have the world be a just place. And karma is one way of getting justice out of the world. Because it kind of guarantees that the sucker is going to get his due sooner or later, because it's a wonderful correlation between every action has a karmic result, every result to you has a karmic source. So, you know, someone has stolen from you, been done something really terrible to you, you've just become poor in your life, and you get to the end of your life, and you've just gotten poor. And someone else, that person's gotten really rich and gets to his end of his life and just, you know, dies merrily with all the toys. And is that justice? And then they say, well, what it is that he's going to get his just desserts in the next life. You know, so that's how the balance, the conservation of justice is maintained by, you know, I have this theory of multiple lives and it all works out over lifetimes. But I don't think a Buddhist idea of karma is meant to be a form of justice. It's not supposed to explain everything. It's not a theory to explain everything, why everything's happening the way it is. Though some Buddhists, especially later Buddhists, as Buddhism developed, took karma theory to be an explanation for everything. And I've heard Buddhists who say that if your retreat center has... a road that has potholes in it, that's because the people at the retreat center haven't practiced right speech. And if everybody just practices right speech, then somehow those potholes will get cleaned up. So we have, I guess, some cracks in our sidewalk. So I don't know what karma that is. But anyway, so we've had septic problems, right, sometimes out here. You know, is it because of our karma? Or was it because of the karma of the previous owners of the building? Anyway, so some people want karma to explain everything. But the Buddha did not want karma theory to explain everything. What the Buddha was trying to do was to point to the tremendous impact that our motivations, our intentions have on our lives. So in looking at our choices that we have to make, the Buddha says it's very important to look at what motivates those choices, what intentions fuel those choices. And to be somewhat simplistic about karma theory, Buddhist theory, we go something like this, that whatever fuels an action, the fuel of an action produces more of itself. So if your action is fueled by hate, it somehow produces more of itself, or produces more, maybe say it a little bit more, different way. If our intentions are unhealthy, that unhealthy fuel produces more unhealth. If our intentions are healthy, it produces more health. If the actions the intentions that fuel our actions are healthy, it tends to produce more health. If the intentions that fuel our actions are unhealthy, it tends to produce something unhealthy. So, for example, if I hate, so the action I do is motivated by hate. That tends to produce a certain effect, puts in motion a certain cause and effect relationship that creates some kind of disease for myself or the world around me. Now, if I act on hate, I set in motion two distinct causal chains. One is that there is a kind of physical cause and effect relationship in the world. So, if I do something hateful to all of you tonight, I won't do it, not intentionally, then you could get hurt. Some of you could leave here and be distressed. Some of you could leave here and be angry. You can get in your car and drive really angrily and run through a red light and get a ticket. And so somehow there's a cause and effect kind of chain that gets set in motion. You can see the conditionality, how my hate conditioned certain behavior in you, and then that goes on, ripples out into the world. It doesn't have to ripple out in the world. Some of you have spent 45 minutes meditating first, so you're cool and collected, and you're tracking yourself, and you see you have a choice, and you say, well, I don't know what Gil was about today, but, you know, I'm just going to leave that at the IMC. I'm not going to take that with me. And so you get in your car, and it's forgotten that I was being mean. And so you drive home mindfully and clearly. And so you don't get your traffic ticket. Or, you know, or then you leave here and you're the subject of whatever cause and effect thing that's happening out there. So there's a kind of what I call physical causal thing that gets set in motion, sets of conditions. That is not what the Buddha was talking about as karma. If you put a ball at the top of a hill and push it down, it'll roll faster and faster. That's not karma, that's just kind of the way the ball works because of gravity. The karma theory of the Buddha has to do with the causal chain, the causal conditions that are set in motion in directly by our intentions. The intentions themselves, especially when we act on them, operate in certain kind of tracks. So we have to understand what is the appropriate tracks that intentionality works at. And I think for that, we have to see that primarily intentionality works within ourselves. That's where the real primary track is. So for example, there is the instant karma that we have. If we do something that's really generous and we feel really happy because of it, we feel happy in doing the act of generosity, that intention of generosity instantly has produced a sense of well-being. That's called instant karma. But it also produces something down the line. So one of the things that our actions produce is memory. We remember what we've done. And that memory is not something that's, you know, disappears, but actually can have a profound and a very important influence on our lives. And meditators will sometimes see this because sometimes, especially on retreats, is memories of that are long since forgotten will bubble up. And they haven't really been forgotten somehow deep in the body or in the psyche. They're kind of there. And we're just so busy living our lives that we haven't actually processed or finished dealing with certain events in our lives. And so it's common for meditators to have all these things bubbling up that's 20, 30, 40 years old because it's unfinished. And so it somehow has to be finished. The mind has to process it. And sometimes it's unfortunate things we've done and we feel really bad about it. And I've known people who actually had to go and make amends after 20 years. They call up someone and say, "Remember me?" "No." "Well, I want to apologize." Anyway. Because somehow when you get really quiet and still in the mind, the mind gets very peaceful, it gets to a point where you realize that further peacemaking in the mind is that it won't be possible unless you somehow resolve some of the conflicts or some of the issues that are unresolved. So the memories will come back and show that. Or there can be really good memories that come back. When I was beginning to learn to meditate on a regular basis, I started having memories of when I was a child of 6 or 7 or 8 years old, of feelings of tremendous well-being that I'd have laying in bed at night before I fell asleep. And just feeling complete and whole and very peaceful. And when I started meditating as an adult, I had forgotten those memories. Not only forgotten the memories, I'd forgotten the felt sense of that well-being I had as a child. And as I started meditating and tapping into this or coming towards that edge of possibility of that kind of well-being and peace, then those memories resurfaced. And I didn't have to resolve anything about it, but those memories surfaced and they became a support for me to go further into the happiness or well-being that meditation can provide. So our memories we carry with us to some degree. And good memories can produce sense of happiness or delight for a long, long time. And bad memories can produce the opposite for a long, long time. I'm still, if I think about certain things I did 40 years ago, 30 years ago, actually feel kind of off. You know, still affects me. If I spent the whole day thinking about some of the things I did, at the end of the day, I think I'd feel lousy. Because, you know, but those memories still have some, I don't know if charge is the right word, but they, they're not necessarily happy memories. So the intentions that we live by give us memories. The intentions we act on give us memories. And don't underestimate the power of those memories in our lives. The other place that, the other kind of track that intentions have is they affect our physical body. When we act with fear is in our intention, then it produces certain tension in the body. The body contracts, perhaps. Or anger or aversion contracts the body. And if you live chronically, trying to protect yourself from the world, that's your intention. Or chronically in a state of greed or ambition, always wanting, the mind's always going, wanting, then the kind of physical body is affected. And that you also will notice this if you start meditating regularly, because some of the holding patterns of the body get revealed, show themselves. People start noticing, I didn't know my shoulders were so tense. I didn't know I held so much tightness in my belly. I just taught this month-long retreat. And there's one person who came to interview after 3 weeks in the retreat and basically said, I did not know that I carried this chronic tension in my belly. You know, the person was probably 50 years old and realized it had always been there as an adult, but really hadn't really known it was there in some ways, had been at a distance from it. But as the mind gets really still in meditation, this chronic tension of fear in her belly revealed itself. So the intentions we live on regularly, especially, will affect our body. And sooner or later, our body, we have to come to terms with that. It affects us. In an extreme form, it affects our health. And a person could get quite unhealthy because of the kind of tension they carry. Another way that track that intentionality works within us is it works within as a conditioning of us. It sets up a habit formation. So as a habit gets formed, it becomes easier and easier to do that and harder not to do that. I've noticed, for example, that if I get a little bit too enthusiastic or frantic about cleaning my house, you know, I got to do a lot of this cleaning and running laundry has to go and this and that and doing all this stuff. And being very efficient, doing all this stuff and stuff, doing. And at some point, the basic stuff has been done and I stop. And I can sometimes feel that my mind is still on this got to do stuff track. The momentum is still there. I can't put it down. Got to do it. What is it to be do here, you know? And it's this habit has been created. Well, some of us do the same things over and over again, you know, for decades. We're always defending ourselves. We're always trying to measure ourselves against others. We're always judging other people to make ourselves safer. Or we're always kind of, you know, trying to make ourselves as comfortable as possible in every possible situation. We're driven by comfort. Or, you know, there's all these kind of very common habits that we have that represents a certain motivation. And the more we act on that, the more it can become a habit. And the habit can become something that sometimes kind of drives us rather than we driving it. So, for example, addictions can be that. Addictions to cigarette or alcohol or almost anything. Even the addiction to talk. You know, some people just can't stop talking. And, there's such a strong momentum, such a small drive to talk that... you know, they don't. They're just always good. They're always there. So, what's often said about intentions is intentions are seeds. And so, if you act on certain intentions, you're planting certain seeds. So, if you plant seeds of hate, of greed, of lust, of delusion, then, you know, it's one thing to plant one seed, but if you keep planting them, then in a sense you kind of keep nourishing them, keep watering them, and they grow and they grow and they grow until, you know, it becomes our character almost. So, why this focus on intentions? Why is this so important in Buddhist practice? It's because the world of our happiness and our inner peace is primarily a product of our intentions. And that's a surprise for many people to hear, because many people think that our happiness is dependent on the stock market. Or happiness is dependent on my, you know, who I've managed to partner up with. Or my happiness is dependent on getting a good job, or all kinds of things. And these things can be conditions for happiness, but it can be kind of fleeting and kind of unstable to have the world be the reason for why we're happy or unhappy. In order to become mature spiritually in Buddhism, we have to learn how to discover to be, we have to learn how to be happy or at peace, independent of the conditions of the world. If we're always looking for the conditions of the world to be just right, your happiness will be fleeting at best. But if you want your happiness to be stable, then you need to find a kind of happiness or peace that's independent of the conditions of the world. So whether you have a job or not, you have the capacity to be at peace with yourself, or even to have it be happy. Whether you're in a relationship or not, whether you're healthy or not, whether you have a good job or not, whether you have recreational opportunities or not, whether you have a good house or not, that if we can learn how to be happy independent of those conditions, then we can say, then Buddhism says you have a stable happiness. And that world of happiness that's stable and internal has a lot to do with our intentions. So if we monitor our intentions, our motivations, and make choices based on which motivations produce health and happiness and which do not, then it's possible to set in motion conditions that make it possible to be more and more happy. So it's said that if you act on intentions of generosity or on personal integrity or on kindness and love and friendship or compassion, that those are watering those seeds, and they help to form and shape the inner life in a particular way. And it forms in such a way that you're much more likely to discover a capacity for inner happiness. If you act on greed or hate or delusion, you create different kind of internal conditions. I remember once when I lied to someone, and the lie seemed to help very much that moment. But it set in motion all kinds of problems. Internally in me, you know, I felt terrible, and then I felt I had to lie again in order to get around it and hide the lie, and then I was worried about getting caught, and then this and that, and it just became a mess. So, you know, it creates a situation where it's hard to be happy if you're really worried about your ethical integrity and the effect of it. So certain activities, certain intentions are conducive towards creating more inner happiness, and certain ones are not. And the ones that are going to create stable sense of happiness are the ones that are said to be health producing, or the ones that tend to be skillful or wholesome. So the ones that are based on love, generosity, and wisdom. So those are the primary kind of roots for the healthy motivations. There can be others. And so if you want to be happy or create the conditions for a more stable inner happiness, you want to begin being the gardener, the tender of your intentional world. So you want to be able to stop and look carefully at what is motivating this activity right now. What's motivating what I'm about to do? So learning to stop and consider your intentionality then becomes a very important thing. So you're in the present moment, you've gotten that far, and then you see you have a choice, and then you can ask yourself, what is my intention in the choice I want to make here? Why do I want to say what I want to say? Now, speech is very interesting to do this analysis for, because most of the time, we're not talking because the person we're talking to essentially needs to have this important piece of information. It's not about just giving information, right? Because like someone stops you and wants directions, how to get to San Francisco, then you just give them information. But speech acts have a lot of motivation and intention around them. We're trying to have a relationship with someone. We're trying to communicate much more than facts and information. We're trying to accomplish much more. Sometimes we're trying to show ourselves so that other people will see us in a certain way. We're trying to manipulate somehow the situation. So what's the intention behind saying what you're going to say? To look at that. It's very, very interesting. Stop and look. Stop and pay attention. One of the great supports for the study of intention is your physical body. To really be in touch with your body, feel your body, be in touch with your physical experience of being in a body. So you can notice the tensions and the release of tensions. You can notice the warmth and the energy in your body. That becomes a very important guidepost for understanding the effect of your intentions. Because if your intentions are ones that are going to produce disease, you'll feel that disease in having that intention. If you feel hate, you'll feel physically what that's like in your body, the anger or whatever, and it just doesn't feel good. And if you have genuine generosity, you'll feel good. You can feel that physically. So it doesn't have to be only a mental analysis, what's the intention here and the results. You can actually feel it in an embodied kind of way. And then it helps to spend time reflecting on what your intentions are before you do certain activities. Sometimes you can plan ahead, even. So, for example, it can be small things. It can be as simple as going to the market to go shopping. What's the intention? It's to get food. That's pretty simple, right? Well, that's fine, but it's a lost opportunity. You know, you're going to do it. How about infusing that shopping trip with some intention? Like, I'm going to shop for food in such a way that I'm really present for the experience of shopping, as opposed to trying to get over it as quickly as I can so I can get on with my life, to the important things. And so to be really present for shopping, as if that's the only thing important to do at that particular moment, has a different karmic effect than rushing through the job as quickly as we can so we can get home and meditate. Or it could be you decide to go to the market and you're going to try to practice acts of kindness there, to be generous to the people who are there, and maybe to the clerk. So you can do that, and if you start living your life making choices like that, it tends to create a different kind of garden in your mind or in your heart than if you don't ever consider what your intentions are and you're just kind of being swept along by the kind of winds of desires and reactivity that's within us. Also, it can be very helpful to spend some time thinking very deeply about big decisions in our life, intentions behind the work we have, work choices, or, you know, major turning points in our life. To really spend careful time, maybe going off someplace for a week by yourself or a few days by yourself, to really think carefully and deeply, what is my intention? What's my motivation? Why am I doing this? To really get clear. I once spent a whole year looking at my intention and the purity of my intention before making a big decision for my life. And the whole year, it was very, very, very productive time to look and look and look and look. What's my intention for doing this? And then one of the very significant things to do around intentions is to, on a regular basis, ask yourself, explore for yourself, what is the deepest intention that you want your life to be based on? What is the purpose or the motivation that you would like your life to be centered on? And that's an interesting one to do regularly because that can change and morph over time. And it's interesting to watch it. And if you keep doing it, you might be able to kind of refine it or take it to deeper and deeper levels. So, for example, if you ask yourself, what's my deepest intention for my life? And it turns out that what comes up for you is a negative statement. And what I mean is by the absence of something. So say you come up with, oh, I would like to live without fear. It's a great intention. Some people are completely motivated by fear. So I'd like to live a life without fear. But that's a negative way of stating an intention. Turn it around and make it a positive statement. It might take it one step further. So if you can live without fear, that is so I can connect in a deep, loving way with other people. So that's my intention, to have a deep, loving connection with people. So that's a, you know, well, that's actually a whole, that's, then becomes a different thing than saying live without fear. Does that make sense? So hopefully you'll put up with me as I talk a little bit longer. It's after 9, and I'll be quick. My intention is to be quick. So in the Buddha's teaching, the if we want to be the custodians, the caretakers of our happiness, we don't look at the world externally to make us happy. But we become the caretakers of our own inner life. And the primary way we do that is by working with our intentions. As we create greater health in our inner life through living, acting on healthy intentions, it conditions the mind in ways that make it easier to practice the Buddhist path. As we practice with intentional, you know, with good intentions, it becomes easier to practice with good intentions in the future. It becomes easier and easier. But more important, as we practice more and more with good intentions and have a sense of happiness and inner sense of well-being and peace, it becomes easier to let go of the things we're clinging to. And this is one of the great, kind of, I don't know if secrets, but great aspects of Buddhist teachings, is that if you really want to be able to let go of the things that you're clinging to, it's easier to do that if you have some happiness, some sense of well-being. And some of the things that are hardest to let go of, you need help in order to let go of it. So to cling to, some people, you know, one of the deepest things to cling to is our sense of self, our self-identity. And our selfishness, our self-preoccupation, self-concern. So how can we, in a healthy way, let go of that? And how can I let go of my self-concern and still be okay? Well, you can let go of your self-concern, your self-attachment, easiest if you're first happy. And then you're still left with your happiness. You know, you're not left with nothing or less, you know, blank state, but you're left with your sense of well-being and happiness. And then finally, to create the conditions in the mind, in the heart, so that you have a sense of well-being and ease and peace, then it becomes easier to do the greatest letting go that the Buddha was pointing to, which is the experience of liberation or freedom. And this is to have an to be in a shorthand, to have an experience of the mind or the heart that has been liberated from all intentions. Isn't that great? So the point is not to keep kind of, you know, just endlessly having intentions, but you're trying to set the conditions together so you can have the experience of really letting go of all intentions. And then you might say, well, wait a minute, I wasn't concerned about my intentions at all until I came here and heard this talk. And well, actually, unless you actually have some degree of liberation, intentionality is part of every moment of human consciousness. That somehow every moment of human consciousness is filtered or informed or influenced by intentionality. And most of the time we don't have a clue that's operating. It's happening kind of unconsciously or subconsciously, just going along. We want stuff, we don't want stuff, this and that, and this and that, all this stuff. Trying to understand things. Even the mind thinking, trying to think about things generally. There's some intention in thinking about things. Some direction we're trying to go. And so you might feel quite peaceful and at ease because the flow of intentionality for some reason is unobstructed. But still intentionality is there. And the tremendous treasure of Buddhist practice is pointing to that possibility of a mind, of a heart, which is resting or settled on itself in such a way that it is not driven by any intentionality at all, where the intentionality disappears completely. It's not about mind is not about anything. It's not trying to get anything or do anything. And since the idea of self is so much to do with intentionality, self disappears. A certain kind of sense of self, a mind or heart, a sense of being present in the world, which is transparent and luminous, at peace, where it's not about me anymore. It's not about what it can do for me, what I can get from it. It just is. I hope that this has made the Buddhist karma theory a little bit more understandable and showed you that also that you're responsible. You're in the driver's seat. Thank you.